John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org, for Monday, August 1st, 2011. Hundreds of residents stranded at Rafah Terminal, and Israeli military kills two Palestinians in the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Egyptian authorities prevented 450 people from entering Egypt through the Rafah border crossing with Gaza on Sunday, despite the recent opening of the crossing. According to border officials, this denial is not permanent. Individuals who were blocked will be given priority soon. Also, those crossing for educational purposes or in need of medical care will have priority this week as well. The crossing was reopened in May, but Egyptian authorities have been tightly controlling the number of individuals allowed to pass through each day. In the West Bank, Palestinian medical sources reported that Israeli troops shot and killed on Monday at dawn two Palestinian youths in Qalandia refugee camp near Ramallah and seriously wounded a third. The source identified the two slain youths as Mu'tasim Adwan, 22, and Muhammad Khalifa, 30. Khalifa is an officer with the Palestinian Security Forces in Ramallah. A third resident, identified as Ma'mun Awad, was critically wounded after being shot by a live round in his back. Local sources reported that a large military force invaded the camp on Monday at dawn, stormed into and violently searched several homes, causing excessive damage and leading to clashes with residents who hurled stones and empty bottles at them. The sources added that the soldiers also kidnapped three residents and took them to unknown destinations. Two of them were identified as Anas Manasra and Ayman al-Khatib. On his part, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Dr. Salam Fayyad, condemned the killing of the two youth and said this is part of the ongoing Israeli criminal policy against the Palestinian people, adding that Israel should be held responsible for these acts of violence. In a separate incident, a group of fundamentalist Israeli settlers set ablaze on Sunday evening 150 dunams of farmlands that belonged to residents of Ain Jalud village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Hassan Douglas, in charge of the settlement file in the northern part of the West Bank, stated that the armed settlers torched the lands while the army did not even attempt to stop them. He added that this is not the first attack against Palestinian lands and orchards in the same area, in addition to similar attacks in other parts of the occupied West Bank. That's all for today. At the end of our newscast, we would like to extend our best wishes of Happy Ramadan to all our Muslim brothers and sisters in different parts of the world. Please join us again tomorrow for a summary of important events in the Palestinian territories. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rishmawi.
Afghanistan, Friday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of undisclosed nationality from an IED attack and from an unspecified insurgent attack. Afghanistan, Sunday, NATO is reporting the deaths of three soldiers of undisclosed nationality from a non-combat related incident in an undisclosed location in western Afghanistan. Pakistan, today, gunmen burned at least 10 more NATO oil tankers in Pakistan's Sindh province as a convoy was proceeding to Afghanistan. The province's capital is the port city of Karachi, where NATO supplies arrived be taken by road across Pakistan to Peshawar and from there across the border to Afghanistan. Geo News reported four people, including three drivers, were seriously injured in the attack. The flames spread to a nearby hotel and three shops, according to police. Tikrit, Iraq, last Thursday. The deadliest attack in 3 weeks killed at least 16 people and wounded at least 30. First, a car bomb detonated outside a state-run bank. Then a suicide bomber dressed as a cop set off a second bomb in a gathered crowd of police and soldiers. At least seven Iraqi soldiers of the 4th Brigade and a real cop were among the dead. Most of the dead and wounded were members of Iraqi police or military units, and most of them were Kurdish. Saladin Province, Iraq, Saturday. U.S. forces killed three members of an innocent family and wounded seven other people during a pre-dawn raid on the village of Rufiat. The dead are Sheikh Ahmad Hassan and two of his relatives. The victims fired on their attackers, thinking they were terrorists. The U.S. has not said whether the intended target of the raid, named Firas Yasin Ahmad, was captured or even determined to have been nearby. Quote, Abdul al-Sumadi, who heads the Security Committee of the Provincial Council of Saladin, where Rufiat is located, describes the raid as a massacre against civilians. We will not let them go free after this action. We will chase them in all the international courts because of the criminal action they carried out today. U.S. troops raiding homes in Iraq? U.S. troops doing things in Iraq that lead to criminal prosecution? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before by George W. Bush in summer 2003. Washington, 31st of July. American soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq were warned that they might not be paid after President Obama failed in a Saturday night attempt to reach a settlement over the U.S. deficit. Quote, U.S. troops fighting in Afghanistan have been told that the Obama administration is expected to make their salaries a lower priority than interest payments to foreign bondholders. In 2007, it was Code Pink talking about cutting off the funding for war. By the end of July 2011, it was the Republicans talking about cutting off soldiers' pay and presumably their ammunition to pay the bankers first. Prosecution and pay cuts. Just what your soldiers want to hear about. Mr. Barack Obama, even if you have signed Sunday night's so-called compromise bill by the time this is aired, surely you know, every soldier in the military knows that that congressional commission is coming back to the issue in a matter of months, and they could then be looking at permanent pay cuts, just like people on Social Security and Medicare. You cannot afford these wars. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. On the 1st of August, Antonio Benjamin Martinez, entrapped by the FBI for allegedly planning to bomb an army recruiting station in Maryland, asked a federal judge to dismiss his case. He is Muslim, and when he said some things on Facebook the FBI didn't like, undercover FBI agents approached him and chose not to record their first four meetings with him, no doubt as they tried to browbeat him into doing something that would get him arrested. After repeated meetings with these undercover FBI agents, he finally agreed to detonate a car bomb at a military recruiter for them. I can just see what those agents were saying. Jihad is a pillar of Islam. Are you really a Muslim? I can see them challenging his manhood, telling him that Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan set off car bombs, so why won't he? The FBI then went so far as to provide a fake car bomb and let him try to set it off. Why a car bomb? In case someone on the jury didn't object to a suitcase bomb with no civilians injured or killed, no doubt. We've seen this before, with the Sacramento 3 Earth Liberation Front case and the FBI's civilian undercover helper, Anna. She did the exact same thing, save that her words were chosen to trap environmentalists instead of Muslims, and even though it all came out in court, Eric McDavid still got a long prison sentence after both his co-defendants snitched. At least since Antonio Benjamin Martinez was working alone, he has only one snitch to worry about, Facebook, the people who started the whole thing. If you have any disputes with the government, any at all, don't use Facebook. Lastly, while fundamentalist Christians are in Maryland blustering threats against a Germantown abortion clinic, with a clinic burned in Texas just last week, the FBI is busy chasing Muslims, environmentalists, and animal rights activists and building fake bombs. Should they not instead be chasing the anti-abortion extremists who use real bombs?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. What are they really smoking on Capitol Hill? If they don't pass that bad deal on the debt within 9 hours of this being recorded, the U.S. defaults on its debts. U.S. troops in Afghanistan have been warned that the bankers might get paid instead of them, to say nothing of Social Security recipients. Yet, this was a deal from the dope man. The worst details have been kicked down the road with another congressional committee that can even address so-called entitlement reform. To the half of that committee that will be Republicans, that means kicking Social Security recipients, those on Medicaid and Medicare, and maybe even your Section 8 rent voucher to the curb. If they can't make up their minds, automatic spending cuts, including payments to doctors accepting Medicare. Guess what happens to your doctor's appointment when he gets that news? Although it is no longer required to pass, that balanced budget amendment is still in the plan with an automatic up or down vote in Congress if the committee doesn't come up with a plan first. Care to guess what happens when a balanced budget amendment runs into a pledge not to tax the wealthy? The rest of us get hammered with user fees and service cuts. Although Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare have been spared in the first round of this deal, with a commission plan down the road, that should be considered temporary. There are no increases in taxes on the rich or on corporations, as the Tea Party has the votes to block any budget plan that addresses revenue. There are cuts to the military, but not nearly enough to balance the budget,
with fair social programs other than Social Security and Medicaid. If this deal passes, the Tea Party scores a huge victory over President Obama by forcing him to get down on his knees and sign a proposal with no tax increases for the rich and keeping all those George W. Bush tax cuts. This is also a huge defeat for the poor and the American people at the hands of the Tea Party. This is truly a deal from the dope man, and if you are hearing this from the Capitol and you haven't voted yet, I've got just one thing to say. Just say no. On the 28th of July, union protesters showed up outside the U.S. Capitol demanding that Congress vote down the Tea Party's debt limit budget proposal, vote down the Tea Party's budget cuts, and insist on fixing these problems by taxing the rich, not cutting benefits for the poor and working class.
In America, we fall to its obligations. While we say to our Social Security recipients, women, our seniors, those who are on disability, children who've lost their parents, veterans, we're going to reach into your pocket instead of reaching into the deep pockets of those who've gotten away with everything.
The millionaires, the billionaires, the large corporations. Today, corporations pay less than 1% of GDP in taxes. 1950, they paid 6%. Our current deficits were created entirely by the Bush tax cuts, two unfunded wars, and the current recession.
One of the speakers even tore up a copy of the Boehner debt ceiling bill containing the massive spending cuts and no tax increases. This was even before John Boehner revised it to include a so-called balanced budget amendment.
Some of you were there, a quarter of a million people in New York against the Iraq war. Somebody should raise their hand. I was there.
I was there.
I was there. And you were proven right. The Iraq war was wrong. The longevity of the Afghanistan war is wrong. So here we are today. Not, how about that? But yet, a man called Speaker can put up a plan that drops the Dow 200 points and talks about, isn't this a joke? No tax hike, no neutral burden. Our soldiers are on the front lines of Iraq and Afghanistan. They want to slide and glide and take no responsibility. They want to cut entitlements and throw seniors out of nursing homes. They want to ensure that there's a balanced budget amendment so they can pay for their goodies and leave you along the highway of devastation. I want you to know that this is a time for those who were there with Martin and those who told us the Iraq war was wrong. You are the American dream, and you need to stand up and fight for those who cannot speak for themselves. This vote, and here's my word. I'm tearing this up, and I'm standing with the Constitution. And I just want to hear you say it. I'm tearing this up, and I'm standing with the Constitution. Boehner and the troops over there will not have a grand dream for America. It's each and every one of you. We're standing with our Constitution, and you are the American patriots. We will win, because the American dream will win.
What an ugly thing John Bonehead and the Tea Party has done. They're holding everybody hostage. They're giving people a choice between their check bouncing this month or all their checks for the rest of their life being drastically reduced or maybe canceled altogether. John Boehner wants to say, I know they say he's John Boehner, I say he's John Boehner, or maybe John Bonehead. He wants to say, if you're sick, go hang yourself. If you're old, take this gold watch and get out of my factory. That's the words of the Tea Party and John Boehner to the American people. Well, I got something to say to them. We don't want their austerity program. They can take their Tea Party austerity and go to hell. In the last week of July, Senator Joe Lieberman, that so-called Democrat who votes with Republicans on a lot of issues, got protesters outside his office. The John Boehner, a.k.a. John Bonehead, approach to dealing with the debt ceiling issue.
Hey, hey, what do we say?
Boehner's plan is not the way.
Joe Lieberman, John Boehner, much more of the sort of austerity we've been hearing about from Capitol Hill for the last few weeks, and it's not going to be protests at your offices you're going to have to worry about. It's going to be protests at your homes. Have they been smoking tea bags on Capitol Hill? As the debate about the debt ceiling wound into the last weekend of July, even the head of the IMF warned the United States about default. Of course, the International Monetary Fund would probably be perfectly happy with the Tea Party plan to end Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare. Probably the IMF would be less happy with a plan involving deep defense cuts, which would make the U.S. less available to enforce the will of corporate power in the so-called developing world. The IMF would certainly be very unhappy with an American budget deficit reduction plan involving deep spending cuts for the Pentagon, tax hikes on the wealthy, and cuts in corporate subsidies. This would be exactly the sort of program the IMF tries to avoid. It would, of course, balance the budget, but balancing the budget on the backs of the rich instead of the poor is not what the International Monetary Fund stands for. Here's the head of the IMF on the question of the U.S. debt ceiling and any possible default.
I talked about the clock. You're immediately ticking in relation to the United States, actually, not so much for Greece, because I think that, you know, the urging of the clock in relation to Greece is going to be now about implementation. Clearly, the critical objective is now to be able to, for the United States, to increase the debt ceiling with a view to avoiding a default.
You can't even say it, Miss Christy Lagarde. Did I hear you right in saying you want an austerity program of the kind imposed in Greece and the United States? The Greek program passed despite 75% opposition from the Greek public and riots in the streets includes taxes on people earning the minimum wage. I guess that's the IMF's way to balance the budget. Don't tax the rich. Tax the poor. Tax the guy making minimum wage working at Walmart. Don't tax the guys that own Walmart, for God's sakes. I don't know what you've been smoking in at IMF headquarters at 19th and Pennsylvania Avenue. And God knows I don't know what they're smoking on Capitol Hill, where they don't want to raise taxes on the rich or anybody else. They want to get rid of Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare. I don't know what they're smoking on Capitol Hill. But it smells like dried out rolled up turds. And believe me, I don't want to hit on that stuff. And I'm just hoping it goes out real soon.
As President Obama and Congress engage in a sometimes nasty public debate on negotiating a legislative resolution to raising the nation's debt ceiling before an August 2nd deadline, the politics of the 2012 election is never far away. Competing policies on addressing national debt, the solvency of Social Security and Medicare, and future tax rates will all be important issues in the presidential and congressional election in November 2012. But as the U.S. corporate media focus their attention on the Democratic-Republican Party debate in Washington, the election campaign has taken an ugly turn in state capitals around the country. Republican governors working with GOP-controlled state legislatures have passed dozens of bills designed to place obstacles in the path of minority, senior citizen, and student voters to cast ballots in the upcoming election. Republican legislative measures, which many critics charge have been enacted to gain partisan political advantage over Democrats, include severe limitations placed on voter registration drives, restrictive photo ID laws, curtailing opportunities for early and absentee voting, and efforts to disenfranchise college students. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. She discusses new election voting laws being implemented in various states, their impact on election participation, and efforts underway to challenge these tactics to suppress the vote.
We have seen a real significant assault on voting across the country, the most significant assault we've seen in decades. We are seeing a range of bills and laws passing across the country that make it a lot harder for people to register and to vote and to participate effectively in our democracy. They come in all different sorts of flavors. One common is very restrictive voter identification requirements, or requirements that people prove their citizenship with certain documentation. There are also laws that make it harder to register, that cut back on early voting, that add certain technical barriers to voting or to having your vote counted. It's been a real broad-based attack on voting, and it will have a significant impact, we believe, in 2012 and going forward.
Can you talk maybe about some of the individual states that many of us have been reading about in Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, and some others?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. One, Florida is a really good example of a state that has just passed a very restrictive set of measures on voting. Florida passed a significant bill that will make it much more difficult for individuals to register to vote. They have essentially made it impossible for voter registration drives to operate in that state, and they've also made it more difficult for registered voters to change their address and still be able to vote a ballot that will count. That's very significant. Both of those are very significant because the rate of voter registration in Florida has been declining significantly over the past number of years, and so this we're going to expect to see it decline even further. They've also reduced early voting. A very significant development and positive development in Florida law that many minority voters, for example, took advantage of in 2008 and in 2010, and now the number of early voting days has been cut back significantly. So that's one example of a set of restrictions that passed. Wisconsin passed an extraordinarily restrictive voter ID law, now perhaps the most restrictive law in the country, that has a very limited set of photo identifications that can be used for voting and doesn't have a lot of options for people who don't have those IDs on them on election day to be able to cast a ballot that will count, and doesn't make it very easy for people to get those IDs if they don't have them.
Wendy, the rationale for many of these laws being implemented across the country by these Republican governors in the Republican-dominated state legislatures, the rationale is that there's a lot of voter fraud out there, that many people are voting fraudulently under false names, that somehow that this fraud is changing the results of elections, so therefore these state governments have to crack down. Is there any evidence that there is a plague, a virtual kind of outbreak of voter fraud around the country that rationalizes this action?
Absolutely not. In fact, to the contrary. Now, to be clear, there are election irregularities and there is some fraud in election, but it is not the kind of fraud that these laws are targeting. Study after study show that individuals showing up at the polls and fraudulently voting and trying to be someone else is just something that does not happen. There have been substantial investigations of elections in a number of states, statewide investigations in Washington State and Ohio, for example, that have shown that the rate of in-person voter fraud is really infinitesimal, that you are much more likely to get struck by lightning than to have an American try and commit this kind of in-person voter fraud.
Wendy, what are the ways in which civil liberties advocates and people who are trying to make it possible for as many citizens to vote as possible who are opposed to these laws, what tools do they have to challenge these state laws under federal jurisdiction, the courts, or however it would be effective? What can they do?
The Department of Justice or federal courts applying the Voting Rights Act of 1965 might play a role. And in a number of states, largely in the South, but not exclusively, that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, the Department of Justice or a federal court has to pre-clear the law. It cannot go into effect until either Department of Justice or a court decides that the law is not going to have a negative impact on minorities and their ability to participate in elections and elect their representatives of their choice. And a number of states that have passed these laws are subject to that requirement, and right now some of these have already been submitted to the Department of Justice for consideration, like Florida, like North Carolina will be as well, Texas. That's one tool that is available to people in the courts. Certainly the U.S. Constitution and our state constitutions are another tools. We do have a right to vote that is protected under the constitutions of every state and of the United States as well. And if this unduly restricts the right to vote and if people cannot participate effectively, then they might be able to use the federal courts or the state courts as well. People should actually take this assault on voting rights as a rallying cry and say, we will not be discouraged. We will just work that much harder to participate and to mobilize our fellow community members to participate so that nobody takes away our right to vote and our ability to elect the representatives of our choice. So we certainly hope that your listeners take away that message and get energized by this.
That was Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Learn more about legislation designed to suppress the vote at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Over the July 16th weekend, members of Respect DC invaded a Walmart in Laurel with drums, horns, and even a tuba. Singers demanded that Walmart respect DC while holding yellow smiley faces backed by an entire brass band. The whole group was able to enter the store and carry out their mission with no effective opposition from befuddled store security. The music you hear is recorded in the protest itself. The protesters were demanding living wages, labor rights, and realistic pensions and health care plans as a condition of Walmart's plans to build any stores in D.C.
Walmart's coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something? Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. You can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to union. Soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than their male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee a plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
West Virginia, 2 activists from RAMPS, that's Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, have now been holding a tree sit blocking blasting at the Beatree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine for nearly 2 weeks as this is recorded. As of Saturday, it has become the longest tree sit in West Virginia's history. Here's what they had to say as it began.
It used to be the most beautiful place in the world, and now it's just, it's hell on earth, you know.
When we demand that they stop stripping Coal River Mountain, we mean it.
So blasting is important to stop because it's the first step in the mining process.
The reason that people are dying in such large numbers is because people are being poisoned, and there are no other explanations for it.
As I'm getting ready to help some good friends of mine haul their shells up in a tree to halt blasting on Coal River Mountain. I grew up, you know, on that mountain, pretty much. Born and raised, you know, downstream from the Brushy Fork impoundment.
Yeah, it's been something for me that was not foreseen when I first, when Junior and I had been talking about doing this. He wasn't, maybe he was sick, but he didn't know what was up, and then just to see, you know, he's young. I mean, he's 21 years old. It's not like he's been living here for 80 years and is sick. He's been here for 21 years and is like throwing up blood. That's something that you're not supposed to do. You know, that's not something that just like happens.
Cheap electricity is not worth the sacrifice that's being made here in Appalachia.
I'm realizing, I think more and more, that it is a dangerous thing to take, but what the coal industry is doing here is infinitely more dangerous, and I think the risks that we're taking need to be taken to end what is being done here.
No one ever knew there was coal in the mountains till a man from the northeast arrived. He was waving them $100 bills. He said, hey, I'll pay you for your minerals. But he never left Harlan alive.
Here are some longer interviews with the tree sitters in West Virginia who have shut down the Beatree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine, pulled from a video published on the 26th of July.
Coal River Mountain is the last partially intact mountain in the Coal River watershed. You know, they have already tore apart almost every other mountain in this watershed to drag out the coal. I grew up, you know, on that mountain, pretty much. You know, gathering wild edibles and roots and, you know, going hunting.
I mean, these mountains are so biodiverse. There's mixed mesophytic forests, have just a wealth of biodiversity of herbs, like up in the forest up there. This spring, I saw so many spring ephemerals. There are ramps, there's bloodroot, there's black and blue cohosh, like every kind of medicinal herb, spring ephemeral you can think of. These are the richest, like biodiversity-wise, these are the richest temperate freshwater ecosystems in the world. And these mountains have been around for 500 million years. I mean, mountaintop removal is irreversible. There's no way, of course, that they can put the topography back in place, but it goes far, far beyond that. The topsoil that takes hundreds of years to build, reclamation isn't going to fix that. They're not going to be able to put back a stream. When they create these drainages with rocks in them, there's none of the components of the original hydrology, chemistry, biology that are in a living, intact stream.
I came here last summer, and the first, I think the second day I was here, I was at a community member's house, and he, within the first few minutes, brought out this yearbook from high school and was showing us all of the people who had cancer and are either still living with cancer or who had died from cancer. And the number, just like the sheer number of people, was just appalling. And the folks that he said that weren't sick, that didn't have cancer, that hadn't died, were folks who didn't drink the water, who specifically did not drink the water.
You know, coming here and starting to pull data from Freedom of Information Act requests, looking at DMRs, which are direct monitoring reports, which are documents that the coal companies themselves put together, even in their record keeping, you're seeing levels of selenium, manganese, other toxins in public drinking water supplies that in other parts of the country and in other parts of the developed world, nobody would stand for. And because it's happening here, and it's happening to poor communities and rural communities, and because it's happening in a way that allows certain people to profit incredibly, because of those three things, it can happen here, and it's invisible.
There's no question about what it is. It's not, this isn't happening in other places, and this is the reason that people are dying in such large numbers is because people are being poisoned, and there are no other.
I originally came here as a grad student to do research for a master's thesis. Somebody in my position writing reports and doing research in an environment where the regulatory agencies are as captured and corrupt as they are down here, doing that research and writing those reports also needs to be coupled with a strong, public, loud, unified, rowdy, direct action campaign, because good science alone in the hands of corrupt or inept people doesn't do anything. So I'm going to be providing direct support to good friends of mine who are going up into trees on the Slip Ridge mining permit in Raleigh County, West Virginia, down here in the coal fields.
When folks are up in the trees, then the company is not allowed to let off a blast within 300 feet of that the protected structure.
Mm. This direct action is a tree set that I will be up in alongside someone else, and it'll be near a high wall miner, and it will be ending, it will be stopping work from happening. And I'm realizing, I think more and more, that it is a dangerous thing to take, but what the coal industry is doing here is infinitely more dangerous, and I think the risks that we're taking need to be taken to end what is being done here.
It's definitely dangerous, and honestly it is a little bit scary to me when I'm up there and I realize that there are a couple small ropes and carabiners keeping me from falling 80 feet. I don't take that lightly. It's worth it to take this risk, is because I recognize that there is so much at stake. I know that people's lives are at stake, and I know that the peculiar beauty of this region and its biodiversity and the many species that live here are at stake also.
On July 20th, two activists climbed 80 feet high in two trees adjacent to an active mountaintop removal coal mining site at Coal River Mountain in southern West Virginia. The site was owned by Massey Energy, the largest mountaintop removal coal miner in Appalachia, which also owns the underground Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners were killed last year. The company was sold this spring to Alpha Natural Resources, which is continuing the same operations. Junior Walk is a 21-year-old native of southern West Virginia who provided support to Catherine Ann McDougall, one of the tree sitters, along with Eli Shule, who served as the support person for the second tree sitter, Bex Collins. The two support persons were arrested by state police on the first day of the tree sit protest and charged with trespassing. The tree sit continues as of production time. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Walk about his decision to participate in this nonviolent civil disobedience action, which is one of a growing number of similar protests organized to stop mountaintop removal coal mining. He also discusses the goals of the sponsoring organization, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, campaign. The group's acronym, RAMPS, references the wild onion that local residents used to harvest on the Appalachian Mountains, now threatened or destroyed by mountaintop removal coal mining.
After I graduated high school, I tried to go to college, but I was the first person in my family to graduate high school, let alone, you know, want to go to college. So I was stuck here because I didn't really have the means to go. And I did what everybody else does whenever they are stuck here. I went to work for Massey, right alongside my dad at the Elk Run Prep Plant. And he still works there today. That was just a terrible experience. I only worked there for about 6 months. Some days they would just have me, you know, cutting the grass or what have you. Some days I'd be walking the belt line or things like that. But it was just like I always felt like that lump of coal was worth more than what my life was worth. And I should prioritize the production over anything else, and I just couldn't live like that. So after that, I went around from job to job for a while until a friend of the family offered me a job as a security guard on a strip mine, and I took it. You know, I was like, oh, I get to sit around for 12 hours a night and make money. But when I got up there and I seen that, and I was in the middle of that, and I seen the way they were doing, and you know, I seen them destroying that mountain, and I knew the people down below that mountain were going through the same stuff that I was going through when I was a kid. You know, poison water, you know, poison air. You can't even go up on the mountain anymore, mostly because it don't exist, but also because there's gates up, you know, everywhere. You know, people don't have access to the places where their, you know, parents and grandparents, you know, hunted or gathered herbs and things like that. So I came to Cold River Mountain Watch, and I'd known Judy Bonds ever since I was a kid. She used to work at the store with my grandma, and I asked her how I could help, how I could plug in, how I could do something to alleviate my conscience, because I just felt like the most terrible human being making money off of what was going on and what was happening to those people below that mountain. I started, like, writing anonymously for the newsletter and, you know, things that I didn't have to put my name or face out there. And eventually Judy offered me a job. Well, it was Judy and Vernon, the two folks. Well, Vernon's still director of Cold River Mountain Watch, along with Debbie Jarrell, and Judy Bonds passed away this past January of lung cancer. Ever since then, I've been here doing this sort of work, and it's frustrating going up against Goliath. It's the coal industry that controls this state completely. You know, our regulatory agencies won't help us because they're funded by the state, who is funded by the coal industry, and it's everything. Every place you can think of to turn to in the state government here is just, they won't listen to you if you say one ill word about coal or any sort of natural resource extraction. So I decided on my own that legal channels weren't enough to put a stop to what's going on here. That's why I decided to take this stand and try and do whatever I could to protect the community that I come from.
Exactly where are the two tree sitters?
They are in Beetree Holler, which is right next to the Beetree surface mine permit, and where active blasting has been going on. By sitting there as close as they are to the Beetree permit, they cannot blast on a certain section of the permit that they were working on before, and they can't get the coal that was right there.
And Junior Walk, what was your role, and why were you arrested?
I was direct support, which means that I helped get the tree sit up in the trees. You know, I helped haul the water and things and the platform up. And then we waited around for about 4 or 5 hours. They couldn't find us, and they had the entire site shut down for 5 hours because they didn't know where we were. And we eventually seen a helicopter buzzing us overhead, so we figured that that was the police. So we came out, me and Eli did, and it actually turns out it was Alpha executives that were actually flying dangerously close to the tree sitters.
I guess how long they stay up there depends on how long those supplies last, and especially on how aggressive the police are in getting them down. What is RAMP's campaign's goal in doing these kinds of actions?
Well, there are quite a few goals, actually. I mean, the first one we're accomplishing right now. They're not blasting where they were blasting before. And that's really the main goal. The other goal is to raise awareness about this issue on a national scale. And I think that we're accomplishing that quite well. And then the other goal is to inspire the people that live around here and make them remember that they have a choice. You know, they don't have to be afraid of the coal industry. They can stand up and tell the industry that they're not going to take the abuse anymore. And I've had, you know, numerous phone calls from people that knew me while I was growing up, you know, older people and things like that, that have told me if they were able-bodied or if they didn't have to live in fear of losing their only means of income, then they would have been right there with us.
That was Junior Walk, a local West Virginia activist acting in support of a tree-setting protest at Coal River Mountain. Learn more about the opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining at our website at btlonline.org.
On the 26th of July, environmental activist Tim DeChristopher was sentenced to 2 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for doing nothing more than bidding against oil and gas companies on a last-minute George W. Bush land auction to so-called open up Western lands for destruction by oil and gas companies. The bids he placed, 13 in all, disrupted the auction, caused it to be invalidated, and by the time things were straightened out, President Barack Obama was in office and the oil and gas leases were canceled, so the action was successful. Now the courts want their pound of flesh. On the 26th of July, protesters gathered outside federal courthouses in D.C., in Ohio, in about 20 cities in all, and there was a massive protest outside the Salt Lake City courthouse where Tim DeChristopher was sentenced, where he gave this speech.
The world wanted to see how you would react. And you all have reacted with joy and resolve. You've shown that your power will not be intimidated by any power that they have. And that's the most important thing that has happened here this week. Because everything that went on inside that building tried to convince me that I was alone and that I was weak. They tried to convince me that I was like a little finger out there on my own that could easily be broken. And all of you out here were the reminder for all of us that I wasn't just a finger all alone in there, but that I was connected to a hand with many fingers that could unite as one fist. And that fist could not be broken by the power that they have in there. That fist is not a symbol of violence. That fist is a symbol that we will not be misled into thinking we are alone. We will not be lied to and told we are weak. We will not be divided and we will not back down. That fist is a symbol that we are connected and that we are powerful. It's a symbol that we hold true to our vision of a healthy and just world, and we are building the self-empowering movement to make it happen. All those authorities in there wanted me to think like a finger, but our children are calling to us to think like a fist. And we know that now I'll have to go to prison. We know that now that's the reality, but that's just the job that I have to do. That's the role that I face, and many before me have gone to jail for justice, and if we're going to achieve our vision, many after me will have to join me as well. Nobody ever told us that this battle would be easy. Nobody ever told us that we wouldn't have to make sacrifices. We knew that when we started this fight. Every wave on the ocean that has ever risen up and refused to lay back down has been dashed upon the shore. But it's the very purpose of a wave to rise up. Because once it rises above the horizon, it finally has the perspective to see that it's not just a wave, that it's a part of a mighty ocean. And the sharpest rock on the wildest shore can never break that ocean apart. They can never wear that ocean down. Because it's the ocean that shapes the shore. And that's what we're starting to do here today. That's what we're starting to do here this week. With wave after wave after wave crashing against that shore.
we shape it to our vision. Thank you all for being a part of that.